Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back on Awaited's Conversation. I'm going to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. More information at www.mecu.com or go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. It's all right there. We are going to switch gears here and talk about Syria and the contradictions that exist in Syria. The news is conflicting. It affects the entire world, not just Syria alone. But we are here with an interesting crew of guests. So join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We are joined by Omar Hassino, who is an independent researcher who focuses on Syria, writes about the Syrian conflict for Syria Deeply, Foreign Policy, and other outlets, and was recently in Syria. Dr. Stephen Zunis is with us, who is professor of politics and international studies and chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco, senior policy analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus, and author of Western Sahara, War Nationalism and Conflict Resolution, and Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, and Dr. Adil Shamu, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., senior analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus, and author of Equal Worth, When Humanity Will Have Peace. And gentlemen, welcome. Good to have all three of you with us.
Thank you.
Great to be on.
Thank you so much.
410-319-8888 is our number here, so please join us with your thoughts and ideas. One of the things that struck me about the Syrian conflict is, and I mentioned this at the very top of the show at 9 a.m. when we went on, that this is the anniversary of when the Germans entered the Spanish Civil War back in 1937. And one of the things that made me think about when I said that was we're seeing in many ways the internationalization of this conflict in Syria. But unlike for some of us, where you might have been able to take sides in Spain, this is an increasingly difficult conflict to figure out where people stand because it's so complex, especially in our realm of life, and to make good guys and bad guys out of everybody in the world in terms of their struggles, which you can't do a deal. This is a very difficult struggle for people to put their hands around here in America as they read the press.
Talking to me, Mark?
Adil, yes.
Yes. Well, I think the revolution or the opposition uprising was hijacked by Al-Qaeda elements and became sectarian, the Sunnis, with the help of Qataris and Saudi Arabia and the Western nations help, basically, because the Saudis and the Qataris have already pumped in over $6 billion into this war. So that's the problem now we have. There is no specific force in Syria which could really control Syria anymore. As a matter of fact, the opposition has weakened since they have done that. Despite the fact that the Al-Qaeda elements of it has been strengthened.
Omar?
Yes.
Could you comment as well, please?
Yes. Well, I mean, I wanted to speak a little bit about just the fracturing of the opposition that we're seeing right now. You know, in Istanbul, it's been over a week, and the Syrian opposition in the outside still hasn't agreed on a common position, on a restructuring. And we're actually seeing, for example, Saudi Arabia with the United States and France backing one side, backing a Christian communist man named Michel Kilo, who is a more liberal character, and his block of 22 names to add to the coalition to weaken the role of Qatar, Mustafa Sabah, and the Muslim Brotherhood, while on the other side we're seeing Qatar supporting their factions, both the Muslim Brotherhood and a man named Mustafa Sabah, to retain their influence on the coalition. And then these two countries, who are both Gulf Sunni countries, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, are disagreeing on this, are fracturing the external opposition on this, and you can even see it in their media. You know, Al Jazeera Arabic, the Qatari-backed station, is broadcasting all day today and all week last week with the Muslim Brotherhood, saying the coalition shouldn't be expanded, shouldn't be influenced by outsiders, while the Saudi media, we're seeing in Al Arabiya TV, for instance, is all day been attacking the Muslim Brotherhood and Mustafa Sabah and saying we need to add this guy, Michel Kilo. And these are two countries who are both on the same side. And that is, they're not even agreeing, and they're helping to fracture the external opposition. So it does get extremely confusing, especially to people watching here in the United States, to see who's exactly on whose side. That's true.
Steve Zunas.
I think it's important to point out that the initial pro-democracy struggle was broad-based, non-sectarian, democratic, and overwhelmingly non-violent. And they were making real headway in weakening the regime and bringing people together. The problem, though, was that the regime, unlike the case of Tunisia and Libya and Egypt, still had a social base. If you look at the divided, the religious minorities, if you look at the crony capitalist class, if you look at the Ba'ath Party and its vast network of patronage and other things, the power of the military, as many as a third of Syrians, despite everything, are on the side of the regime. So this is going to be a tough struggle, whether the movement was divided or not, or whether it was nonviolent or not. But unfortunately, out of frustration, and more than 3,000 people who were overwhelmingly nonviolent, who were massacred by the regime, people, including some of the defecting soldiers, took up arms to fight. And now we have 70,000 people dead. We have nowhere closer to victory. And we have a situation where, as has been mentioned previously, outside forces have been able to hijack this popular democratic movement into this really ugly sectarian existentialist struggle.
So very quickly, Stephen Zunas, because there's two really big questions I want to get to here. But when you said victory, what does victory mean?
Well, I mean, I think first and foremost, I think in the minds of the opposition, both violent and nonviolent, is bringing down the Assad regime. The problem is what's going to replace it. And there are many of the armed factions who have a vision of a post-Assad regime that is pretty ugly and pretty extreme, and not to mention the prospect that with these various armed factions, it could be a continued civil war long after Assad and the Ba'athists are gone.
I mean, and Omar, one of the things that struck me, I was reading some of the things you've written as well, is that that's part of the issue here. You have Israel saying, well, Hezbollah has now come into the fight, which we'll talk about in a minute. But Israel saying that's unacceptable, that the arms from the Soviet Union to bolster Assad is unacceptable. But what's acceptable then to them or anybody else? A pro-Al-Qaeda government taking over in Damascus? I mean, we don't know it. That's the problem. No, I think nobody can define even what the notion of victory of the future means here.
Well, definitely after this many deaths, after the state has receded in so much of Syria, after all of this destruction, after Hezbollah has intervened on the side of the regime, Al-Qaeda on the side of the rebels, Russia on one side, United States on another side, victory definitely looks like it's a very bad thing no matter who wins this conflict, at least in the short term. It's looking increasingly ugly. And it's getting worse by the day, unfortunately.
Now, I don't know if any of you read the piece that was in Al Monitor by Edward Dark, which is a pseudonym for one of the activists from Aleppo. And he writes, and he's written some really good pieces. And the piece that he wrote in Al Monitor just the other day, he talked about how the they started this nonviolent movement that, as I think you said earlier, Adil, was a broad, or maybe Stephen said it was a broad-based movement that went across class and ethnic lines, nonviolent movement. But he felt it was hijacked, people coming in to places like Aleppo and others and just killing people right and left and not having any sense of ethics, and saying that if he quoted Nietzsche, when he said when you begin a revolution, you can't end up being like those who you're fighting against. And he has this paragraph where he writes, this is what it's come down to in Syria. It's us versus them everywhere you go. Opposition versus regime, secular versus Islamist, Sunni versus Shiite, peaceful versus armed, city versus rural. All in all that cacophony, the voice of reason is sure to be drowned out. Whatever is left of Syria at the end will be carved out between the wolves and vultures that fought over its bleeding and dying corpse, leaving us, the Syrian people, to pick up the shattered pieces of our nation and our futures. And Adil, I think this is what, when you talk to Syrians, this, I think, is the mindset of most regular human beings who live there, who feel completely powerless in the face of all this. And I think the international community does not know how to respond.
Well, unfortunately, like most of wars in the Middle East, once they become big, they become proxy wars. The international forces do not allow the people to resolve their issues, even if civil war. We've had civil war ourselves, and we are, of course, selective where the West interferes. The West have never made clear what do they want. What's the final outcome? How long they're going to, if they interfere, what they will do? How come the UN is not really any more partners? All the time now we talk about Europe, United States, and NATO. The UN really is now second-class citizen in this fight, and that is the problem. That's why the war in Syria is expanding very rapidly. To Lebanon, to Jordan it will go, and definitely has been already in Iraq to a certain extent. Iraq is going downhill, and this is really detrimental. I mean, we holler and scream in the West about the number of 80,000 deaths. Well, we are part of it. I have never heard a word from our government or the Europeans criticizing the sectarian support Saudis and Qataris give, billions of dollars. And that's really what started to fuel the fire in Syria and civil war, and the revolution was hijacked. How come we are silent about that?
Stephen?
Yeah, very well said. I mean, I think the talk of sending in arms is just going to put more fuel on the fire. The vast majority of atrocities have certainly been done by the government, but the rebel forces are increasingly engaging in war crimes themselves. What little remains of the nonviolent, inclusive, democratic opposition is not only continuing to being attacked by the regime, but they are in some cases even being attacked by the rebels because they are reporting human rights abuses on both sides. Clearly, the Qatari and Saudi regimes, their goal is not democracy in Syria. Clearly, they don't believe in democracy in their own countries. The United States and the Europeans have for years supported dictatorial regimes in the region, not to mention occupation armies. And so, the West has very little credibility as well in this highfalutin talk about promoting democracy and the like. And so, there's understandable skepticism among many Syrians about what the outside forces really want, and that unfortunately plays right into the hands of the Assad regime, which has manipulated the strong sense of nationalism among the Syrian people for so many decades.
And Omar, go ahead, Omar.
Yes, I mean, I just wanted to comment on some of this. That article that you cited was very interesting, and I want to say something, that the Assad regime's strategy since the beginning has been to make it like this. The Assad regime, at the very beginning, was saying they were fighting Salafists, al-Qaeda cells, and Daraa when there were peaceful protests going on like we saw in Egypt and Tunisia. You know, one of the early slogans of the nonviolent movement of the protesters in Syria was no to sectarianism, no to violence, and no to foreign intervention. People were going out saying they didn't want foreign intervention and that they didn't want violence. 7 months in and many deaths later, people started taking arms. And months in January of 2012, that's when we first heard of the al-Nusra Front announcing its existence, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. As the months have gone on, there's been more radicalization and more extremism. I think the Assad regime is marketing itself internally and externally as the last bulwark against al-Qaeda in the Levant. You know, it's saying to the minorities within Syria, look, it's either us or these al-Qaeda, and so you need to support us. And honestly, that's working with a lot of people, a lot of groups, a lot of Sunnis even, that might oppose the regime but now are getting scared. And on the outside, He's saying, look, you have Al-Qaeda, you have the PKK. Remember, the Assad regime withdrew from the Kurdish areas in July of 2012, and the PKK took over that gap, that vacuum, which was engineered by the Assad regime. He's saying, look, Turkey, there's the PKK here. Look, United States, there's Al-Qaeda. Do you really want me to fall? And I think that he is pushing and engineering this strategy. We're seeing more and more Syrians coming out wanting some sort of end to the violence. I mean, when Muaz al-Khatib, the former leader of the coalition, announced his initiative for talks with the regime, there was actually a large support for that, both within Syria and within people on the outside of Syria. But you know, it wasn't a popular position to stay. I mean, he was burned by other people in the coalition. He was burned by outside powers. But there's a lot of people that do support at least the notion of this idea. But as this conflict goes on, we're seeing more and more radicalization. I mean, the United Nations just this morning put out a report about how Syrian rebels, they said, you know, while the regime's atrocities were far more in severity and in number, that the rebels have been committing war crimes as well, and many of the rebels do not even believe in the democratic Syria, which I do believe is the case. And as this goes on, it's just getting worse and worse.
So, and we have to round this out. Adil, you want to give a closing thought here?
Well, I think we didn't talk about the role of the United States. What is our role? What do we want? And I think here is what I think I give a left-handed compliment to Obama. He's really trying to resist the forces and the hoopla of going and intervening in Syria. That's one, I think, positive side of him in terms of it doesn't serve our national interest at the moment. And this is being purely pragmatic, which is uncharacteristic of me. what we will do if we send any kind of help, the minute you start no-fly zone, the minute you start the drones, you are really not doing anything and just inflaming it. And if you go full force and control Syria, of course we can. What's going to happen? The Middle East will hate us more. Today's Pew poll in the New York Times indicate the overwhelming majority of Middle Eastern Arabs are against any intervention
so
into Syria.
We have to break now, but we're going to come back to this in the coming weeks and invite our guests back, because this is very critical to not just Syria and the Middle East and the entire world, the internationalization of this conflict, and more. It has to say with, in some ways, what we have unleashed on our own through Iraq and more. Dr. Adil Shamu, Associate Fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies, Senior Analyst of Foreign Policy and Focus. His latest book, Equal Worth, When Humanity Will Have Peace. Dr. Stephen Zunis, Professor of Politics and International Studies and Chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco, also with Foreign Policy and Focus, as Senior Policy Analyst, author of the books Western Sahara and Tinderbox, and Omar Hosino, independent researcher who focuses on Syria, writes for Syria Deeply, Foreign Policy, and other outlets. And good to have all three of you with us. Thank you both so much for taking time with our listeners and in our audience.
Thank you for having
us.
We'll be talking soon. Thank you. And we'll be linking to all their articles. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Ojeda Hall and Terry Hiltner as we look at Baltimore's United for Leadership and Development Build, celebrating its 35th anniversary, and an exhibit that is taking place in our Pratt. Don't go away.